Tonight we're going to talk about the teachings of the forefathers before the giving of the Torah, lessons in Menschlichkeit. Now this goes back to a motto which I like to follow, and that is that everything that we want to find is in the Torah. So if anything which I say tonight, or methods that I raise tonight through some of the narratives which I brought together, you know, in the items which I prepared, if any of it seems obvious, or if any of it seems like, oh yeah, thank you, I mean, we know that already, so I apologize in advance. But I think that the particular circumstances which our forefathers dealt with, and in particular, you know, in their case, with most of the examples which I'll share tonight, are their encounters with certain, let's just say, I mean, obviously not Jewish people, in other words, not members of their family. So, even though that was their particular circumstance and what they dealt with, we can certainly apply their tales to personality types. And as we go through them, you'll get a better feel for what I'm talking about. I tried to divide these into specific categories. You know, there are people who you'll encounter in terms of when you have a disagreement. Right? Somebody wrongs somebody else. How do you respond? Who's at fault? It's a little different than in a car accident. You know who's at fault. Somebody might just be rude, conceited, or arrogant. What's the best way to deal with someone who thinks that he or she is better than you? Sometimes it's just not worth responding. There's this Irish comedian. I was actually listening to him on the car on the way up. His name is Hal Roach. So he has a great line. He says, when in an argument with a stubborn person, agree with them. Nothing annoys them more. That's a different Hal Roach. It's a Hal Roach from the 30s and 40s in Hollywood. A different Hal Roach. So let's say somebody comes to criticize, right? It really depends on if they're open to hearing an explanation. You know, I'll accept your criticism if you're willing to understand where I'm coming from. And on the other hand, depending on the nature of the criticism, I remember when I was in graduate school for education, so a person would give a model lesson, and then we would all critique. And our professor said, okay, your critiques are going to be positive only. What did you like about it? So that was a different method, but it was very helpful in terms of, you know, we're, as he quoted the pasuk from the Shir HaMaal Surah, A, B'tuv Yerushalayim. You go to Israel, you have a lot to complain about, all the things that are wrong with Israel and bureaucracies and whatnot. But Urei B'tuv Yerushalayim, so what if there's bad things? Seek out the good. So that's what we had to do in that class, seek out the good in somebody else. But in any case, some people said, you know, give it to me. I want to hear the bad stuff. I want to hear what I did wrong. I can take it. And even those who said they could take it, once people started laying on thick, they couldn't usually take it anymore. So critique has to, first of all, come, you know, with love, and on the other hand, it needs to be constructive, and it needs to be presented in a way which is acceptable. You know, in other words, in a way that somebody's going to accept it. At the same time, if a person is not going to see the whole picture, so in a model lesson, we know we're critiquing the way you gave the lesson. Okay, we're critiquing your style. We're critiquing what you did, the choices you made, the choices that you didn't make, where it could have been better. But if somebody comes over and says, you know, I noticed the way you behave a certain way, I'd like to critique, you know, I'd like to offer you an insight. Okay, but make sure that you're ready to accept my critique on your critique because of the way that you're presenting what you want to say. So in other words, it has to be able to go both ways. If you're not willing to hear what I want, my feedback to your feedback, then please don't give me any feedback because nobody's perfect, including the criticizer. So we'll see a number of cases where there is actually no recorded response. This seems to indicate that what came before was not worthy of a response. And certainly a dispute of some kind, you know, is at times appropriate, you know, a debate, if you will, but only if both sides respect each other at the outset, respect their rights to an opinion, and are willing to hear the other side. Just to bring an example, I remember around Thanksgiving time here, when I spoke in shul, so I mentioned this video, which had gone around in emails, maybe some of you saw it, which was called A Yeshiva Guy Tells Over a Vort. So you remember, because you were interested in the website. It's called Extra Normal, which makes those cute little animated videos. So it was a guy basically telling over a story to a cynical, if you will, listener, saying, you know, the forefathers kept the Torah. Oh, really? Did the forefathers keep the Torah? And the guy explains, you know, he has a nice different idea about why Yaakov gave Esav bread along with his lentil soup when Esav sells him the birthright. So that was the premise. And the other person said, what do you mean the forefathers kept the Torah? How did Yaakov walk into the Aron, into the Kodesh HaKodeshim on Yom Kippur? Yaakov wasn't a Kohen, and there was no Beis HaMikdash. So how could he keep the Torah? So now, it lends itself to a lot of different questions, granted. In response to it, so somebody put up a different video saying, you know, when you have an argument, you have to respect the other person's opinion, listen to what they say, and argue on the merits, but you first have to respect that the other person has a right to have an opinion, even if you disagree. Calling the person a fool because you don't like what they've said is not a constructive way to have any kind of conversation. So not that we're going to be taking our lessons from animated bears, but I thought that at least that response is a good opening or an introduction to, or at least a conclusion to my introduction of the samples which I shall now proceed to bring. So the first one is what? No, I don't have handouts. Oh. This is all open discussion tonight. Okay. But the truth is, you're probably all familiar with these tales, so to look at them would just waste our time in terms of reading it. I mean, not waste our time, but it would take extra time in terms of reading. So the first tale is the one where Avram and Sarai go down to Egypt. So in Egypt, Sarai is abducted, and it soon becomes clear that she is actually the wife of the man who came down with her, who claimed to be her sister. So in the morning, Paro calls Avram and says to him, what have you done? Why didn't you say she was your wife? Why did you say she's your sister and I took her for me to be a wife? Now take your wife and get out of here. Now Paro asks him a few questions. The next pasuk tells us that Paro commands men on him and he sends him out and his wife and everything that he had. How come Avram doesn't respond? Well, because when a person wants to criticize you and won't even understand if you're going to offer an explanation, sometimes it's not worth responding. You just walk away. Right? Nothing, like Hal Roach said, agree with them. Nothing annoys them more. Imagine, you know, what can you imagine that Avram said to Paro? You're right. She's my wife. She's not my sister. Okay, I'm sorry. That's it. End of discussion. Were Paro to say, oh, you know something? I really understand what you're talking about. You were really afraid I was going to kill you. Paro's not going to say that. Paro's going to say, oh, you're afraid I was going to kill you? Okay, so I'll kill you. I'll kill you right now. So in that case, it wasn't even worth a response. And so that's why I think Avram didn't respond. The next case, actually a similar one. Well, actually, I'm skipping around. I'm not going to go in the exact order the way that is in the Torah because I wanted to keep things that are connected. So Yitzchak has a similar example with Avimelech. Okay? But in that case, Avram responded. Okay, Avram did respond. So here, the people ask about, this is in Bereshis Perchavav, the people ask Yitzchak regarding his wife, and he says, she's my sister. And the Torah tells us he was afraid to say that she was his wife, because maybe the people will kill him because it's Rivka. So Avimelech is looking around, and he says, you know, he's looking, and one day he walks by and he sees through the window and he figures out that Yitzchak and Rivka are husband and wife. He calls him in and he says, it's your wife. How did you say that she's my sister? So Yitzchak responds to that. Okay? Presumably, Avimelech gave him a forum to respond. Why did you say she's your sister? And Yitzchak said, well, because I said to myself, I justified to myself, I thought maybe I would die because of it. In other words, I would be killed. So Avimelech says, well, what did you do? You know that somebody almost slept with your wife and that would have brought shame upon us? And now Avimelech behaves exactly like Paro. And Avimelech makes a commandment to his nation, anybody who touches this man and his wife will die. How come he doesn't say, how come Yitzchak doesn't respond? Yitzchak, you know, it's a great opportunity for Yitzchak to say, you know, you guys have a real problem. That any time a woman comes into town, you guys think that you can have your way with her. Well, it doesn't work that way. Yitzchak doesn't do that. Why not? And I think that because it's the same idea. What did Avimelech say to him? Avimelech said, do you know that somebody almost slept with your wife? Yitzchak's looking at him and he must be thinking, are you kidding? What planet are you from? You know, I mean, we come into town and you just assume that you can have your way with anybody? And now you're blaming me because I tried to protect my own life, as I just explained to you. And now you're saying it's my fault because one of your sickos almost slept with my wife. Or with my quote-unquote sister. Without permission, without asking, you know, a hand in marriage, without courting, without dating, anything like that. And so Yitzchak's looking at him, I mean, basically incredulous and saying, I mean, you got to be kidding. I got nothing to say to you because what you're offering or what you're suggesting is so far out that I absolutely have nothing to say.
Okay. Pharaoh was the king. I mean, you're going to talk back to the king like that?
Well, he already did talk back to him. Why did you say she's my sister? Because I thought you'd kill me. Well, do you know somebody almost slept with her? He doesn't even seem to be so abrasive. He's just, you know, this is what almost happened. Do you realize how terrible that would have been? He doesn't seem to be attacking Yitzchak in the same way that Paro was attacking Abraham. He seems to be more like, whoa, you know, that was a close one for us. And Yitzchak says, okay, it was a close one for you, you know. I mean, but he doesn't say anything because there's nothing to say. What are you going to say? Okay, let's move on. The next example is Abraham with his nephew Lot. Do you want to say something?
Should we save questions for later?
Yes, please save questions for later. Unless you want to ask him now.
Write him down.
Write him down. Okay. The next case is the example of Abraham and Lot. So Abraham and his nephew Lot were both very wealthy after the Mitzrayim story, after they returned from Egypt. And the Torah tells us that they were not able to live in the same area because they had too much cattle and not enough land. So there was a fight between the Avram shepherds and Lot's shepherds. So Avram came over to Lot and he says to him, and listen to Avram. I mean, the fighting, of course, is legitimate. You know, it's like one of the earliest sources of this field ain't big enough for the two of us, right? So Avram says to him, let there not be a fight between us, because the bottom line is, we're brothers. The whole land is before us. If you go left, I'll go right, and if you go right, I'll go to the left. So Avram doesn't only compromise, because he loves his brother, you know, what he calls Lot, his brother. It was his nephew, but they used the language of Achim, we're brothers. He doesn't only compromise, but he leaves it up to the other guy. He says, you decide, and I'm going to follow. There are equal opportunities, equal ways to go, but I leave the ball in your hand. Whatever you choose to do, I will respect and I will honor, because it's not about me. What's most important is Alna Tehi Meriva. I don't want there to be a fight here. And I think it's a very powerful lesson, by the way, just in terms of, you know, what it means to be a mensch. When a person looks at the options that are available from an objective perspective, so, you know, if at the end of the day, if you're going to choose route A or choose route B, bottom line is, it doesn't really matter, then the two sides need to have to be able to come to an agreement in the sense where they could say, you know what, I'm cool with it. But the most important thing, though, is not to let it be, you know, whatever choice is made, for it to be an executive decision. The whole point here with Avram and Lot is that they're having the conversation. Avram comes along and he says, look, I can have this thought process and this is what I'm going to do. And I have come to the conclusion that for me, either way is good. I can go right, I can go left. And so Lot, the ball's in your court. But Avram had the, I don't know if you want to call it maturity, the wherewithal, the ability to look beyond my own personal preference. And he said, look, I could really go either way and I want to leave it up to you. Does that mean that Avram would have preferred, you know, to go to the east where I mean, probably not to Sodom. You know, that's where Lot, you know, ended up. But is it to say that Avram preferred going left or right? We have no idea, because Avram left the ball in Lot's court and gave Lot the opportunity to make the choice, which in the end, of course, Avram completely respected. Would he have respected it if Lot had chosen to go to the west instead of to the east? I would say the answer is yes, because that's the way Avram left it. That Lot chose to go to Sodom may have worked to Avram's benefit. Avram stayed in Hebron, Avram stayed in Beersheba, in those places where Avram was. But Avram worked himself to the point where he was able to accept whatever choice Lot would make and allow that to work for him. Okay, the next example. The next example is how to deal with an abrasive personality. So this is the story of Avram at the end of the war, where he has actually saved his nephew in Lot. In Sodom, Lot who had been captured. So after Avram defeats the four kings, so the king of Sodom comes out, and he starts to talk to, or we actually he doesn't do anything yet. Before he gets to say anything, a different king who was not part of the, what's the word? Fricassee? Is that the right word? Wasn't part of whatever had taken place. His name was Malki Tzedek, and he says, and he blesses Avram. He brings out bread and wine, and he blesses Avram, and he says, "Blessed are you, the God on high, Konei Shemayim Va'aretz, who acquired heaven and earth, and blessed is God on high, who watched over you." And then the Torah tells us, "Vayiten lo ma'aser mikol," which seems to imply that Avram gave him a tenth of what had been won in the war. Then the king of Sodom comes along and he says to Avram, "Tain li anefesh v'rachush kach lach, give me the people and you can keep all the booty." Now, let's take a step back for a second. Avram came and saved Sodom, who had been defeated by the four kings. Okay, that means the king of Sodom owes everything to Avram, who saved his hide. This guy comes out and says, "Give me the people and you keep the booty." As my nephew said, my Israeli nephew said, when I told him that my name, when he hasn't seen me in a long time, he said to me, "What? His name is Tani." He said to me, "What's your name?" And I said to him, "It's Tani." Obviously, it's not Tani. And he had this look on his face and his, you know, smile from ear to ear. And he was calling me Tani for the rest of the day. Later on, when he discovered that my name is not Tani and that I'm actually his Uncle Avi, because he knows that he doesn't have an Uncle Tani, he says to me, "Are you joking me?" So that's basically what Avram must be thinking when the king of Sodom comes over to him. He says, "Give me the people and you keep the booty. Are you joking me? Hello? There was a battle. The rules of war are whoever wins gets to keep everything. It's all mine." Now, Avram doesn't say that, but instead what he says is this. He says, "Harimosi yadi el Hashem el yon kone shemayim v'aretz." I'm going to raise my hand to God on high. First thing he does, he says, "Don't insult me." You see, you should learn a lesson from Malki Tzedek, who talked about el elyon kone shemayim v'aretz, talked about God on high, who acquires the heavens and the earth. First of all, take a lesson from that guy, because he wasn't even involved, and he came along and said, "You're the man. You won the war. I'm going to bring a gift to you." He brought lechem v'yayim, bread and wine, to Avram. Then Avram says, "Imichut v'yad siroch na'al v'imekach mikol ha'shalach v'lo tamar ne'e sharki es Avram." I'm not even taking a shoelace, a string, a shoelace, nothing, because I don't want you to be able to say that you gave to me, because I see the way you operate. I see the way you want to take credit and say that you're the one who won this war, when you owe everything to me. So, but you're turning the tables on me because you're that kind of low life, because that's the way you operate. So I'm going to turn the tables back on you, and I'm going to say, you're not going to be able to have the upper hand here. So I'm willing to walk away from everything, even though I'm entitled to everything, because I won the war. I'm willing to walk away from everything so that you will not be able to walk over me. What's Avram? What has Avram done? Avram has given, 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 and all this person wants to do is take, take, take. that type of person needs to be put in his place. But in the end, but look how Avram does it. He says the next pasuk is Biladai Raka Sherachulane Arim Vachelokan Hashemarsherachluti Anerish Kol Mamrehem Yikhu Chalkam. He says the only people who are going to take things are my friends, and only what they've eaten, because we're all exhausted and tired from the battle. But that's all we're going to take. We're only going to take what we've already taken, and that's it. But I want you to walk away from this episode, Mr. King of Sodom, feeling as shameful as you are because you're a despicable human being. Now, Avram doesn't tell him you're a despicable human being. And the king of Sodom probably won't understand that and take that from the conversation because, frankly, it's way over his head to understand how much he is in the wrong here. But that's the way Avram deals with him. Avram says, look, this is your attitude. You're wrong. But nonetheless, I'm going to let you feel like you win. And I once had a similar story, and I think I may have told the story here a few years ago. When I don't remember when I told it. It was pre-Pesach, and I was going to one of these, when I was in New York, I was going to one of these all kosher supermarkets. And there was not a parking spot, you remember the story, there was not a parking spot to be found. And the way it was, they have this angled parking, and you know, when you see somebody loading up their car, so you basically wait for them to pull out. So a person was loading up a car, so a woman was in her car waiting to go there, and I saw a few spots up, somebody else was loading up her car, so I pulled up to get her spot when she pulls out. Turns out the first person loading the car wasn't leaving, just loading the car, and fine. The person I was waiting for was leaving. Now, by all rights, I think, who gets the spot that I'm waiting for? I do. I feel sorry for the other person, you know, that your person wasn't leaving, but I'm waiting here. We're not even on the same line. So the person who was waiting for the parking spot starts honking me as if I need to move to get out of the way. So I park my car, get out of the car, and I said, yes. And she says, I was here first, that's my spot. And I said, what I just told you, and I'm sorry that happened, but it doesn't, you know, I don't think it works that way. She says, I was here first, that's my spot. So I decided, I'm not going to get into this argument. So I said, okay, ma'am, you can have the spot, but I just want you to know, I'm being very nice to you. Okay. So I gave her the spot. I drove around a little bit more. I parked the car. I walked into the store, and the first person I bump into is this woman. And she says to me, thank you for doing the right thing.
What do you say?
What do you say? Exactly. So I said, I said, you're welcome. I said, you're welcome. Have a good shot. Whatever it was. But I mean, you know, it's all relative, but I think it's the same story.
Can we go back to the argument you just made? Israel won the war in 1967. Defensive war.
Hold on. If we're talking politics and Arabs, it's a different mentality.
Well, weren't the... the Arab mentality?
It may have been. I don't want to take this and translate it to politics because what I'm talking about is lessons in Menschlichkeit, and I'm taking an individual example from the way Abraham dealt with a specific person. And if you're going to start talking about an Arab mentality and a certain way which frankly I can't explain. Because it goes.
We're supposed to take a lesson from Avraham Avinu.
We took your land,
but okay, you guys deserve it. Here it is.
But they never had a claim.
What? What land?
Their land. It's their claim. It's their land. How am I going to argue with them?
It's not the same comparison. Our next example. Okay, so that was how to deal with an abrasive personality. The next one's a little more complicated, but it's what I call how to deal with a difficult or treatment of a difficult personality. See, Avram had always been yearning for a child, and as had been Sarai. And Sarai says to Avram, I'd like you to please take my maid, and you're going to take her as a wife, and whatever child she has, I will build a family with this. So Avram takes her, she becomes pregnant, and then the Torah tells us that she denigrated her mistress on account of the fact that she became pregnant pretty quickly, and Sarai had never become pregnant. Yes, sir?
She didn't offer her as a wife. I think part of the problem is that she offered a surrogate womb. And the change comes because something that happens between Avram and Hagar, and she holds Avram responsible.
That's true. I mean, that may be true. The Torah says, "Vatitein osa le'Avram isha," to Avram her man, her husband, "lo le'isha," to him as a wife. I mean, isha usually in that context means wife, not just as a woman. So, I mean, I know where you're coming from. I don't want to get into the semantics of that story because I really want to deal with the after effects. But you know, there's obviously a lot more. I mean, like everything, there's a lot more to talk about all these stories. But it depends on the perspective that you're coming from. And tonight we're talking about the lesson in Menschlichkeit. So with your permission, we'll move on.
I ain't going there.
Okay. Withdraw
the comment.
Okay. So Hagar basically, denigrates or makes fun of, or I mean, it says that they call her that in her own eyes, her mistress was lessened, lessen, because she, Hagar, became pregnant and Sarai had not. So Sarai becomes angry at Avram and she says, you know, look, this is what happened. Yishpot Hashem b'ni u'benecha. She's criticized for that comment. She says, may God judge between you and me. I don't want to so much deal with what Sarai says as much as what happens afterwards. Vayomer Avram el Sarai, hinei shifchasech b'edech, asila ato b'enayich, latanea Sarai, vatevrach mipanea. So Avram says to Sarai, you know what? She's your maid. Do what you want. And so what does Sarai do? Does she throw her out of the house? No. But she makes life difficult for her. Vatanea. Sarai means she makes things difficult for her to the point that Hagar runs away. Now it's a complicated tale because Sarai, you have to remember, she desperately wanted to have a child. She's willing to bring her maid into the relationship to become a third wheel in her happy home, if you will. And then Avram, when the maid becomes a nuisance, Avram gives Sarai free rein. Sarai doesn't kick her out of the house. She gives her a hard time. Maybe that's Mida Keneged Mida, because Hagar, no, measure for measure, because Hagar had given Sarai a hard time. But Hagar flees on her own accord. But when she returns, after she's told to come back by an angel, we don't see Sarah meddling, and we even see Hagar's reacceptance, as far as Avram is concerned, into the home. I mean, she comes back, she has the baby Ishmael, he becomes Avram's full son, as far as Avram is concerned. And there's a piece of some kind. The next time we see Hagar mentioned is after Yitzchak is born, when Sarai doesn't feel that the way Ishmael is relating to Yitzchak is appropriate, and so at that point they are thrown out of the house because that's what Sarai wants, and Avram is told by God, listen, you got to do whatever Sarai tells you. Or at that point she's Sarah, whatever Sarah tells you. So yeah. But at this point in time, I mean, how do you deal with the difficult personality? So I think that what Sarai did, you know, is what to take note of. I don't know if it's something to learn from, but essentially she said, look, I've given you everything. I've given you a home. I've given you a job. I've given you a place to live. I've even given you the opportunity to become a mother, which for some women, I imagine, is a great goal to have. And as soon as she becomes pregnant, immediately she turns on her mistress. And she makes her feel less than nothing. And Sarai says, how dare you? Where's your hakaras hatov? Where's your appreciation? Where is the all that I've given to you, you're willing to throw it out in a second on account of whatever has taken place here? And the way the tide has turned, you know, you spent one night with my husband and you became pregnant. It seems so easy for you. How dare you? Where's your sensitivity? Where's your appreciation? And so Sarai says, well, look, if that's the way it's going to be, I can play hardball. Now, I don't want to make Sarai to turn into some vindictive, you know, hair-pulling, pathetic woman. But we have to understand the context in terms of where she's coming from. And I guess her feeling was that Hagar needs to be taught a lesson. She didn't throw her out of the house. She didn't say, get lost. But she said, you're going to make my life difficult? I need you to learn a lesson. You need to understand what difficulty is. We don't know what she did to her. All we know is Vata'aneh Sarai. And as soon as Hagar gets the lesson, she runs away. And the Malach tells her, listen, just deal with it. Sarai will get over it. And it seems Sarai does get over it, because, you know, we are not told over and over again, and Hagar seems to be living in the house for at least the next 15, 16 years until Yitzchak is a little tyke. You know, not just at the bris, it's a few years later when Sarah throws Hagar out of the house. So she's been there all along, which means that somehow they must have come to a peace. But it's only after, you know, Hagar went through the experience of saying, okay, now I know what it feels like. Well, that's good. Sometimes a person needs to know what it feels like. And I think that's what Sarai wanted Hagar to walk away with, a feeling that if you can't take it, don't dish it. Now I'm going to dish it. Can you take it? And Hagar couldn't take it until the angel said to her, you got to learn how to take it. You got to be an adult. You got to stand up for yourself in whatever way, but be respectful because you have to know your place. And I think that's a lesson Hagar learned. And whether Sarai did it in the right way or did it in the wrong way, I think it was an important lesson for a difficult person to walk away with. Okay. The next couple of examples are what I call, when someone wrongs you, stand up for yourself. Okay, so Sarai's is kind of that in a way, but at the same time, you know, it was more to teach a lesson. But when someone wrongs you, stand up for yourself. So let's take a look. But I'll tell you the first case is when it's actually a similar case in both for both. No, I'm sorry. No, it's not. Okay. The first case is with Abraham and Abimelech. The last time that they encounter one another. So Abimelech and his general Pichol, they come and they say to Abraham, Elohim imcha b'chol asher tase, the God is with you in all that you do. And they say to him, swear to us, or swear to me with, you know, God, if you're going to be into shkor liel and niel and achika chesed asher sisi imchat asayim adi ve'im aretz asher garta ba vayomer Abraham anochi ishave. He says, make a treaty with me, basically that you'll be good to my descendants the same way that you were to me. Yeah, Abraham is a powerful personality on a whole number of different fronts in ways in which people view him. And Abimelech is basically looking for a long-term treaty, perhaps because he knows that this land is promised to Abraham's descendants, and that one day they're going to be coming back, and maybe he's afraid that Abraham or his descendants will throw out Abimelech's descendants. So Abimelech seems to be afraid for that. He says, make peace with me. What does Avram says? Fine, I'll swear. V'hochiach Avraham es Avimelech al ados be'er amayim asher gazlu avdei Avimelech. But then Avram rebukes Avimelech on account of the wells that his servants had stolen from Avram. And Avimelech says, oh my goodness, lo yadati mi asas adavar zeh, I don't know who did that. V'gama tali gadatali, you didn't tell me. V'gama nochi lo shamati bilti ayom, and I never heard about this before today. So Avram, what's Avram's response to that? You know, modern day, you know, the pundits would say, when somebody comes along and says, oh, I didn't know anything about it, the pundits would say, really? Really? You must have heard somebody on the radio. Come on, really? Really? Avram doesn't say anything to him. Because Avram's thinking, Avimelech, come on, you're the king. You don't know what's going on in your country? Are the blinders so tight that you can't see anything? Avram goes ahead, Vayikach Avram tzon uvakar, Vayitein Avimelech, Vayichrasu shnei habris. And Avimelech says, oh, I didn't know anything about it. And Avram basically says, here's the animal, let's make the covenant. He ignores his comment completely, because Avram knows either that Avimelech is lying, or that he's so out of touch with reality, that there's no, I mean, what are you going to say to somebody like that? What do you say? Oh, I didn't know. What do you mean you didn't know? Of course you knew. What are you going to say? So Avram says, all right, listen, we already made an agreement. We're going to make this covenant. Fine. So I'm not going further in this discussion. Let's just do it, get business done, and then you live on one side of Sinai, I'll live on the other side of Sinai until there's a revolution of some kind. Okay. What's Avram doing there? Avram knew what he stood for. And he criticized Avimelech. Hovehochiach Avram as Avimelech. He criticized Avimelech. You know, before Avimelech gives this ridiculous response, Avram says, look, I'm happy to make a treaty with you, but I want you to understand that you've done something wrong. Because you didn't do anything. You didn't rein in your people with regard to the stealing of my wells. That Avimelech's response is ridiculous. Okay, let's agree that Avimelech's response is just a little nonsensical. But look at the way Avram treated him. Avram says, okay, look, I'm happy to move to the next stage of our relationship, but I want you to recognize that you've done something wrong. And that's a concession that Avram makes, but it's a concession that comes with the price that somebody needs to acknowledge that something bad took place. And Avimelech does. He says, oh my goodness, had I only known, I wouldn't have done anything. He may be lying through his teeth. Could be. Maybe he's telling the truth. But at least he learned the lesson, which is something that nobody had ever told him before. Sometimes you need to say, you know what? I don't want to have this discussion anymore. You win. Enjoy. But I want you to know you're wrong. You're 1,000% wrong. And you can say whatever you want. I've looked at it from all angles, and there's no way to justify what you're doing or the way that you're behaving. So as long as you understand, and you've heard me out, that you're wrong, then I'm willing to move on and to make peace with you. But I want you to know, and I've done this with people, by the way. And usually it doesn't take them more than, you know, one session of enjoying the benefits of what they were looking to get before it tastes really bad and really dirty, and they turn around and they say, you know what, forget it. I was wrong.
You're talking about dealing with reasonable people, with sane people. When you're dealing with somebody, people who can be shamed. When you're dealing with people who can't be shamed, unreasonable, chauvinists, you can't do this.
Right. Well, I know that. I know. That's why I gave the example of Paro. That's why I gave the example of Paro at the outset, where Avram just leaves. Here, Avram, he doesn't just walk away. He says, "Look, we made an agreement to have a covenant. So let's just do the covenant. Let's get over with." But the conversation's over because there's nothing more. Is Avimelech going to feel guilty beyond this? Now, Avimelech should be giving Avram a lot more than just a covenant, where Avram's really doing everything for him, saying, "Sure, I'll leave your grandchildren alone." That seems to be more of a concession on Avram's part, and Avimelech doesn't get it. So I'm taking it a step further and saying, "Look, I hope that the person that we're going to deal with in this certain type of circumstance will get it, because hopefully a person's intelligent, a person has a little bit of guilt or a little bit of a dose of reality, and says." You know what? You know, I thought about it and I realized I'm really barking up the wrong tree. You're right. Enjoy. Avram's not saying you're right. Avram's saying you're wrong. I'll make peace with you, but you're still wrong.
And an unreasonable man or a meshuggah says, so what?
Right. Okay.
Good deal.
So then don't make peace with that person. That's your choice. You could be the better man or the better person, or you could not. That's your choice. Avram is saying, I'm going to be the better man. But I'm not going to walk away without at least saying my piece. And some people just need to say their piece. Somebody was just telling me. I think maybe it was my wife. She was telling me that she went somewhere. She went somewhere and, oh yeah, yeah. She was in a store. She was in a store and trying to push a double stroller in. And somebody started yelling at her. How dare you bring this thing here or cut me in the line or whatever it was. And the way my wife tells the story, she says the person clearly wanted to continue to explain to her why she was wrong. So my wife said to her, "You're right, I shouldn't have done that." The person's like,
what are you doing?
It's like, "What are you doing? I had a lot more to say. Sorry, I just deflated you. I apologize for deflating you, but okay, you're right, you win. What do you do? I mean, obviously you're gonna come across people who are difficult people and who aren't gonna get it. Some people will get it, and we hope that we deal more with the people who will get it. And then again, we're not always right. You know, in this case, I think Avram's point was that he is right, but he could have just as easily have been wrong. Sorry, I mean, Sorry, I have to say that I could have been wrong. Okay. The other example of when somebody wrongs you, stand up for yourself, is Yaakov. Yaakov wakes up in the morning, looks in his bed, and behold, wrong wife. Right? It's Leah. And he says to Lavan, "What have you done to me? Halo v'Rachel avadati imach v'lama rimisani? Didn't I work for Rachel? Why'd you trick me?" Yaakov's question legitimate? Absolutely. V'yomer Lavan lo yasachein bimkomeinu laseisad tzi'ira lufnei abechira. We don't operate this way, to give the younger one before the older one. Fill out a week and I'll give her to you again, as long as you work for me for another 7 years. I don't know about you, but that sounds a little ridiculous. I mean, you want to say, well, wait for Sheva Brachos to end and then you can marry the other one, assuming that's normal. Okay, let's assume that's normal. For another 7 years' work? Are you crazy? Are you kidding? Leah was a freebie, man. Rachel's the one I work for. If you want me to be married to Leah, all right, I'll take her, I'll support her, whatever. But I already did my time. What does Yaakov do? Vayas Yaakov came. Yaakov does it. Vayimale shavu azos vayitin los Rachel bitolo liisha. What does he do? All right, fine. But man, are you crazy? I mean, he doesn't say anything. What's he? He's going to explain to Lavan why Lavan's wrong? Look at Lavan's logic. You know, we don't operate this way. I mean, hello, Lavan. 7 years ago, I told you that I wanted to marry Rachel, your younger daughter, and you withheld this information from me for 7 years. What were you waiting for? You know, the chickens to root? I mean, what is it? What's the phrase? What were you waiting for? To share this piece of information with me? He doesn't say anything because he knows that it's not going to penetrate. Lavan is a different planet of a type of personality. So Yaakov doesn't say anything. He says, all right, fine, you know, fine, we'll do that. What else am I going to do? It's not like Yaakov had prospects at home, so he was away. He couldn't go home anyway. Yeah.
Kind of the problem is that these people have Ruach HaKodesh. I mean, he realized he wasn't ready for Rachel at that point. His mother also had told him that it was an amount of time that he was supposed to get ready for Rachel, but he was not sufficiently ready for her.
That's the 7 years.
No, but I'm saying that it wasn't just, Lavan, he realized this was not coming really from Lavan. I mean, he realized
that he would have to work for 7 years?
What I'm saying is that for us to take those models and say, okay, I'll work for another 7 years without the benefit of being Yaakov is kind of hard.
No, I'm sorry. If that was the message that you took, that wasn't what I was trying to say. I'm not saying I'm saying that what Yaakov basically said to Lavan is, all right, I'm accepting your terms,
right?
Even though, but he doesn't give a response to Lavan because he knows it's just going to fall on deaf ears. He's not saying to Lavan, and you're wrong. Yeah. He's accepting. Yeah, Yaakov obviously is a special human being that he's accepting these terms and he's going to go through with it. I'm not saying we're supposed to accept a 7 year, you know, type of prison sentence on account of somebody else's misdeed.
Right.
But the point is the way Yaakov treats Lavan. He could say, are you crazy? First of all, here's the divorce document for Leah, and Rachel and I are eloping and we're running away. He could do that. He has every right to do that. Right? But he doesn't do that. Because Yaakov is a different kind of mensch. Right. That's my point.
Yeah, but what I think she's saying is that because he had Ruach HaKodesh, he knew at the end of the day he would walk away with Rachel and Leah, and he walked away as a very wealthy person. He had lots of property, sheep, goats, land, whatever. And, God blessed him.
I hear what you're saying, and I accept the concept that Yaakov had Ruach HaKodesh and how that may have played into how he operated. At the same time, the Torah and Yaakov's actions themselves do not support what you're saying. Because as soon as Yosef is born, at the end of 14 years that Yaakov has been working for Lavan, No, No. Yosef was born at the end of that those 7 years. Yaakov comes over to Laban and says, I'd like to go home now. Do I have permission, please? Yaakov has nothing. He hasn't worked for himself. All the time he's working for Laban. And Laban says, no, God's been good to me since you've been here. Please stick it out. And Yaakov says, fine, but then I need to work for myself. So you may have had the Ruach HaKodesh, you know, and we could debate how much Ruach HaKodesh means. Does he know everything that's going to happen in the future? I would argue no. I don't think that's what Ruach HaKodesh means. But certainly the way Yaakov acts seems to indicate that he is ready to go home penniless before he's become a wealthy man.
Why did Rachel give Leah the signal?
That's one midrash. There are other approaches as well. Why Rachel did that? I can't answer per se why she would do that. And you know the classic explanation is that Rachel was concerned about her sister. She didn't want her sister to be embarrassed. But there are those who say that when Leah refers to herself as being hated, or she says, I'll tell you, Evani Ishi, that now my husband will love me, that what Leah was actually saying was, I am hated. And you know why I'm hated? Because even though, because she could have said to Lavan, Dad, I'm not going along with this. And even if she is going along with this out of respect for her father, which is debatable whether she could do that, she could have said to Yaakov, Look, Yaakov, it's really Leah. So all the time you're calling me Rachel, just go along with it, because my father wants it this way. But it's really Leah. The fact that she didn't do that, one could suggest, and there are commentaries who say this, made Leah literally hated in Yaakov's eyes. And it took time for Yaakov to get over that. It's very hard. I mean, I don't know. Somebody pulled that off to me. Whatever it is. Right, it is. That's a different discussion. You know, I mean, unless you want to say that Leah and Rachel were identical twins, which is possible, by the way. That's open. If Yaakov and Esav were twins, there's room to suggest that Leah and Rachel were twins, even though...
How much older was Leah? A minute or two?
Yeah, it could be. It could be. I mean, the Torah... Again, I don't want to get too far off the topic, but the Torah changes in terms of the way it refers to them. Sometimes it's referred to as Gedola and Kitana, bigger and smaller, and sometimes it's referred to as Tzira and Bechora, the older and the younger. I mean, that's Yaakov and Esav. How much older? I mean, Yaakov was born supposedly holding, not the Torah says, holding Esav's heel. So they're not even a minute apart. They're seconds.
But the one is the first one.
Right, but one's the first one, right. So, I mean, how much of a difference? I don't know. The Torah doesn't tell us anything about their birth. It only tells us about, you know, it only tells us a little bit about them. So that's a discussion going into Midrash land about Leah and Rachel and their relationship, which I could talk about a different time. But tonight we're talking about the Menschlichkeit of the forefathers. So you'll forgive me if I don't go further into that. Okay. There are a few more examples. I've got 7 more examples, and I'll try to get through them quickly. I know it is a little late, because we started a little late, but usually we go for about an hour. So with your permission, and even if not without your permission, I'm going to go for another 11 minutes. Okay.
Menschlichkeit.
That's why I time it on here, so I know exactly when an hour is up. Okay. Our next example, Menschlichkeit, being there for your child. So we spent a whole series talking about this, and that's how Avram relates to Yitzchak in their conversation as they're going up to the Akedah, when Yitzchak says, Avi, and Avram says, Hineni Bani, I'm here for you, and they walk together. We talked about it in its day, so I'm not going to go further on that. How Avram and Ephron conduct their business deal in terms of the purchase of Me'aras HaMachpelah. So the way in which they talk, now there are different ways of interpreting it, but they are, at least on the most surface view, extremely respectful to one another. Adoni Shema Eini, my master, please listen to me, hear me out. I want to give it to you. It's so kind of you. Please, my master, you listen to me. Avram bows down to him. You take. No, I don't want to take. I want to purchase. No, we're friends. Keep it. No, please, I want it to be legitimate. Let me pay for it. Fine, you're going to pay for it. Here's the cost. There are some say Ephron inflates the price. Some say he gave it a fair market value. It's open to a lot of interpretation. But on the simplest level, without coming with a bias that Ephron is a bad guy, the way in which they relate to one another is a beautiful model of how to deal with somebody, certainly in business, and perhaps anybody you're going to talk to. Just respectful, courteous, with a goal in mind that both people are looking to get to. Okay. Our next example is, if you're in the right and the others are completely in the wrong, sometimes you just need to live your life until others come around to the realization you knew all along. What is that? That's the story of Yitzchak and Avimelech when he is living in Gerar after the incident with his wife. So Yitzchak lives there and he becomes very wealthy and he undigs the wells. And eventually, Avimelech comes over to Yitzchak and says, get out of here. Lech mi manuki etzantu menu mi od. So he basically tries to kick Yitzchak out of town. And Yitzchak goes off and he moves somewhere else. And eventually, about 15 psukim later, Avimelech comes to Yitzchak and Yitzchak says to them, why have you come to me? You hate me. You sent me out of your land. And they say to him, well, we saw that God is with you, because Yitzchak has become very wealthy in this time, and he's been blessed in many ways. And we decided we don't want there to be any animosity between you and us, so we want to make a covenant with you. Okay. Now, Avraham made a covenant with these guys, so what are they doing? Well, they're afraid that Yitzchak isn't going to honor it because of the way they've treated him. They broke the covenant, they kicked him out of town, so their feeling is, well, maybe Yitzchak's going to get back at us. So they say, "In ta'aseim anu ra'ah kasher lo neganucha v'kasher asinu imecha rak tov v'neshalechecha b'shalom ata baruch Hashem." They say, "If you're going to do any bad with us, if you do bad, in the matter that we haven't touched you, and just as we've been good to you, and we sent you off in peace, so now baruch Hashem." Now I don't know how that sounded in Hebrew, but in English it makes no sense. We were good to you, we weren't good to you, we sent you away, but we really like you. Baruch Hashem. And Yitzchak said, "Vayas lahem mishtev ayochlu vayishtu." What's his response? All right, guys, let's eat and drink, because that's what we agreed we were going to do. Basically, just like his father. He says, I don't know what planet you guys are from. You kicked me out of your land, right? Imagine Spain, 1492, okay? They kicked the Jews out. And many countries in Europe, every country in Europe at some point in time kicked the Jews out. You kicked the Jews out. Okay? 10 years later, they see that their economy is in ruins. 5 years later, they see their economy is in ruins, that nothing is the way it was because the Jews are gone, let's say. And they say, we made a mistake. Let's go over to the Jews again and say, hey, guys, something? Let's make peace. Any Jew in the right mind would say, wait, are you joking? Are you joking me? As my nephew said. You guys threw us out. You hate us. Oh, no. We realize you guys bring so much to our land. Things haven't been the same since you left.
Well, Spain did say that. They just waited 500 years.
Yeah, okay, right. That's right. Right, that's in every... But, it defies any sense of ration, rationality, to listen to that and say, all right, fine, I'll make peace with you. But yes, Yitzchak does. Because Yitzchak says, you know what? You guys make no sense, but I'm above it. I'm better than that. And that is another element of Menschlichkeit. Okay, a couple more examples. This is a beautiful one. Okay. We good there? Okay. The Dudaim story. If you're familiar with it or not, Rachel is desperately trying to have a child. Leah's had a number of children. Reuven goes out to the field one day, her oldest son. He comes back with these flowers, which are supposedly fertility flowers. And Rachel desperately wants them, so she says to Leah, give them to me. So Rachel asks for them, and Leah says, okay, you can have them, but then I get Yaakov tonight. Okay, that's how the story pans out. Yaakov comes in from the field in the evening. Leah comes out to him, and she says, "You're going to come to me because I basically purchased you for the evening on account of flowers. Now you're the husband. You're the husband. You're listening to this, and you're thinking, you what? You know, I mean, look, you're also the husband. You're thinking, okay, whatever, I don't care. You know, but you know, what do you mean you purchased? Can you explain to me what's going on? Like, what kind of conversations are you and Rachel having? You know, when I'm out working in the field?" But he doesn't do that. You know why? Because the outcome of the circumstance doesn't hurt Yaakov. Okay, so tonight Leah, tomorrow night I'll be with Rachel. Doesn't matter, right? It doesn't hurt him per se. And frankly, to find out the circumstances would only embarrass both Rachel and Leah. Okay, so if the end result doesn't hurt you, Yaakov is saying, just go with the flow. As long as you recognize that something took place that, you know, obviously concerns you, but it doesn't concern you as far as the women are concerned, in Yaakov's case. I'm not taking the parallel and saying people should have two wives and have these types of conversations. Don't go that way. But in terms of, you know, if people have a conversation and they say, look, we talked about it and this is the conclusion. And you say, all right, I'm good with whatever you choose to do. It's fine. Then you don't have to ask. Give me all the details. Because it may be embarrassing. You don't know what went on behind closed doors to get them to agree. If in the end they agree, great, you agree. Now what it took, it's maybe you don't agree with what took place. Maybe somebody had to agree to something extraordinary. But if the person agreed to it, that means that somehow it works for them. And they're willing to go through that in order to get the result which they're asking you to join in. So if that's the case, go with the flow, Yaakov is saying. Okay. Second to last one is, be courteous even to your greatest enemy. That's just referring to the way Yaakov and Esav treat each other when they finally meet each other at their encounter. It's worth reading, but I'm not going to go into it now because I want to do this one. When mad at someone, make it all about your experience. And this goes back to the story of Yaakov and Lavan. When Lavan comes to Yaakov after Yaakov has run away, and Lavan basically get into a screaming match. Lavan says to Yaakov, "What'd you do? You stole my heart. You took away my children. Why'd you run away? You robbed me. You didn't tell me. I would have sent you away. You didn't let me kiss the children. I got nothing to say to you. I could have destroyed you, but your God came to me in the evening and said, don't touch him if you want to survive. You stole my gods." Now, Yaakov says, "Look, I was afraid. I said, you know, maybe you wouldn't let me keep your daughters. And by the way, with regard to the gods, anyone who took them is going to die." So Lavan goes ahead, and Yaakov says to him, "Go look wherever you want." And Lavan goes ahead and he looks, and guess what? He can't find them. So now, finally, Yaakov gets upset with Lavan. Now, you're Yaakov. What are you going to say? What are you going to say? Tell me. You're going to rip Lavan, right? You're going to tell Lavan. You're going to give Lavan a piece of your mind. You're going to say, "You fill in the blank. What you've done to me, what all this time, all you do, all you ever say, ever, all the time, you always." Look at what Yaakov says. He says, "What have I done? What's my sin that you chase after me? You've gone through all my stuff. What'd you find? That's mine. Put it here. Let everybody decide. I've worked for you for 20 years. None of your animals have miscarried. I haven't eaten anything. None of your animals died on account of being a trefa, or nothing was torn apart by a wolf. Even if something did happen, I would have paid for it out of my own money. You stole from me in the evening and in the daytime. I'm sorry, not you stole from me. I was robbed in the daytime and the nighttime. In the evening, I froze. In the daytime, I boiled under the sun. I didn't sleep for 20 years. I worked for your 20 years. I worked in your house. 14 years for your daughters. 6 years for your sheep. You changed my wages dozens of times. Had God not watched over me, I would have left empty-handed." Yaakov basically puts it all on himself. He doesn't yell at Lavan. He says, "Look, this is what I've done. This is what I've been through. Can't you recognize that? This is what my experience has been." He's trying to show Lavan, "Look, you know, I really don't want to get into this fight because this is what I've been through. And for me, I'm past it. I just want to move on with my life. I got my wife, got my kids, got whatever I have. You know, let it be a thing. And so Yaakov, as did Yitzchak with Avimelech and Avram with Avimelech, he made a peace treaty with Lavan, and he said, "Let's move on our way." And that's what he says. And Lavan says, he says that even after Yaakov says all this, he says, "The daughters are mine, the sheep are mine, and everything you see is mine. And for my daughters, what can I do? You know, or their children." And then he says to Yaakov, he says, "You know what? Let's make a covenant." Why is Lavan making a covenant? Because he knows God is protecting Yaakov. And if he tries to do anything else to Yaakov, he's going to be in trouble. So I have no other choice. I'm just going to make a covenant. Now that's Lavan. Who has the problem here? Lavan has the problem. Because he, like others that we've seen before, doesn't get it. But it's the way in which Yaakov treats him. Says, "Look, you know, I'm just going to lay out everything about me on the line. I'm not even going to talk about you. You'll either get it or you won't get it." And Lavan obviously doesn't get it. But Yaakov is saying, "This is the way I'm going to fight with you. Because to get into cat fights, to start pulling hair, to start saying, 'No, it's you, no, it's you, no, it's you,' I'm not pointing fingers anymore. I'm done with that. I've had the discussion, I've been through it, and I'm beyond it." I think that, I don't think I need to summarize all the things which we've seen. I'm already 55 seconds into my hour. But I think that what we see from the examples here is that when it comes to disagreements, when it comes to fights, you hope that both sides can be menschlich, and in some cases, obviously, one side won't get it, and the charge for those who will get it is to say, "You know what? As best as I can, I'm going to be the better person. I'm going to be above it. When we can come to a concession, I would like to, and I want to have the conversation, and it's important to have the conversation. But if the other person is not going to get it, then when you have the conversation, you let them know, 'Look, this is the way I feel, this is what it's going to be, but I'm not going to fight about it anymore. And I'm hoping that you can be a rational human being and accept, perhaps, and see it my way so that you'll understand, even if you don't agree and even if you're not going to do what I'm saying, because you still think I'm wrong, but you need to hear me out and need to understand why I do feel that I'm right. And then where we choose to go afterwards is going to be the direction that we as rational people will take our disagreement, but that's the lesson that we need to take from this, is that as best as we can, we need to be the better person." And I think that that's what we get from Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov in terms of the way they deal with, in many cases, very difficult people and difficult circumstances. But I don't think that the Torah is trying to patronize them and say, you know, they came out on top. I think that the lessons that we can learn from them is, some cases maybe they were wrong, who knows? But I feel that certainly the way that they're presented in the Torah, they do come out on top because of the way they chose to, in some cases, respond, and in some cases say, "You know what? There's nothing to say. So I'm just going to leave it the way it is, and I'm going to go with the flow, make the peace treaty, and move on."